The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at tntradio.live. This is the No Fly Zone with Greg Mayberry on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Friends, welcome once again to the No Fly Zone on TNT Radio. I'm your host, Greg Mayberry, and it's great to have you with us again. Look, today I'm very excited to talk about a couple of discussions or a couple of topics that are huge on my agenda, not just on this program, but my understanding of history. And those two events are first and foremost the JFK assassination, and the other event, of course, is one that's more recent, is the events of 9/11 and the subsequent war on terror. But before we get into the meat of those backstories of these events, I just want to set out our stall for both this and future episodes of this particular program. My view is this, that we really can't understand world events and developments without having some basic understanding of how those events in the past have directly precipitated or contributed to them in some key way. You know, we have to have a context and we have to have perspective. Put another way, I guess what I'm saying here is that whenever we examine past events, we will always attempt to link their significance to what's happening now with unfolding events. And as Shakespeare once said, the past is prologue. What's that mean? Simply means our understanding of our history sets the context for and provides a perspective on the present. So without any further ado, we're going to be discussing in this episode today the events of 9/11 and the JFK assassination. And we have with us a French author, writer and filmmaker, Laurent Guinaud, and he has been researching the history of America's deep state now for the last 10 years or so. He's been a contributor as well to two of my own favourite alternative independent media sources. That's VoltaireNet.org and the UNS Review, which is UNZ.com. So both of those websites I highly recommend, and you'll find our guest puts in a regular appearance on those websites. He's also produced a film recently looking at 9/11, and that's also available for viewing online. But bottom line, his books and his recent film represent, in my opinion, important contributions to our understanding of the common threads that link these two deep state crimes in American history. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Laurent to the show.
Hello, Laurent, Greg.
Can you hear me?
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Terrific to have you on board. Look, Laurent, can you give us a bit of background on yourself, how you became involved in writing about these events and writing about history in general?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll try to make it short, but my awakening, I would say, was quite usual, quite banal, I think. I became aware of something wrong about the official narrative of about 9/11 about 10 years after the event. And before that, I was actually very much pro-America in a very excessive way for a Frenchman, actually, because I had lived in America and I just loved America, you know, and I saw the America I saw, of course, I had great experience there. But anyway, so even in 2003, I'm almost ashamed to say, but I was I thought America was right to go to war against Iraq and, mm-hmm. So I'm just saying this because, you know, I was not predestined or I was not prepared I was not biased against America, you know, so, but suddenly one day I was made aware by some friends in a very, very classic way. I think I saw a video by an architect and engineers on 9/11 for 9/11 Truth about the Tower 7. I think that must have been the trigger that made me aware that there was something deeply wrong. So I started researching, and then little by little, I tried to understand what happened. I was a bit shocked. In fact, I was shocked at my own credulity. How do you say that in English?
Yes, sorry. Yeah. Naivety, credulity.
Naivety. And so I felt I have to research what I now call America's deep history, or the history of deep politics.
Yes,
so I became fascinated by that topic, and you know, I went back, and that led me, of course, to the Kennedy assassination story, and then I felt we have to go back until World War II, because somehow there is something that started something happened after or during and after World War II that we can say this was the beginning of the deep state, or what actually was named the national security state at the time.
That's correct.
Some shadow government, you know, was kind of created at that time. And then I became a student of that, and I started writing about it, because I felt originally I wanted to write for the French public, because, you know, French people, as everybody knows, are not really good at English. And if you want to research those topics, you really have to do it in American websites. And so that was my original motivation. And, you know, I tried to make a contribution, and that's how it happened.
Yeah, well, look, the contribution, as far as I'm concerned, this obviously motivated my invitation to have you on the show. Certainly, we share quite a bit in common, not only in terms of our understanding of what has gone on in the past, but also to the trajectory that both of us have taken. But you mentioned, I just want to go back to a phrase that you used. You talk about deep history and deep politics. That, of course, is attributed to an author that we both know, Peter Dale Scott. And I do recommend that listeners chase up Peter Dale Scott, and I'll be name-checking one or two other authors throughout our interview today, that where Laurent and I share a lot of the same knowledge derived from these authors. But there was another, in terms of the deep state, we are talking like the shadow government. This is the government behind the government, the powers behind the scene, the powers behind the throne, I suppose. And, you know, people might reject that as sort of conspiracy theory, but it's, as you and I both know, it's, and as you discovered for yourself after at first accepting the story of 9/11, that, you know, things weren't as they appear to be. But you also have an engineering background too, so the actual you mentioned the architects and engineers group in America, or they actually have been a very strong force in raising awareness about the physical and technical and engineering problems that are associated with the actual official explanation of 9/11. So that would have led you down some interesting paths as an engineer, would it not?
Well, yes. But I think my engineering background, you know, gave me some kind of rigor in my my attempt to understand, you know, causes and effect, you know, to think logically that every effect has a cause and so on. I'm not sure if it really if I was really if it was determined if it was decisive in my understanding, because, you know, you don't have to be an engineer to understand when you look at Tower 7 collapsing, like, you know, you don't have to be an engineer to understand that this is a controlled demolition. So But, you know, I have a logical mind, that's what I can say. And I like to connect the dots, you know, in a logical way. And I like to make sure to check every information I get. So I think that's how I could contribute in a way that I don't get into unverified or, you know, you know, kind of speculations and so on. So I try to keep to the facts you mentioned, I wanted to just say something about the deep state and so on. I was thinking about, you know, this is not so mysterious. People think it's a conspiracy thinking to say there is a shadow government. But if you read, for example, Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, something very simple, is that America has two natures. You know, America is the United States is a democracy, but the United States is also an empire. And so there are somehow two governments, you know, there is one government for domestic issues, you know, which is a democratic, and that there's a democratic government somehow. Yeah. But for all issues of foreign policy or military policy, you know, this is not a democracy. It's a fake democracy. People must be given the illusion that it's a democracy. But basically, nobody is the American people are not asked to decide whatever. So you know, this is has to do with this dual nature of the United States, and the shadow government or the deep state or the national security state, you know, which would be its almost official name, is basically the government of the empire. You know, this is the that's one way to look at it. In any case, of course, a little bit more complicated, but
I just want to go back to a point you made. I think it is absolutely important that people don't get into sort of speculation about these things, that people really have to go away and look at the evidence. The evidence is out there. It's not, you know, it's not out there in your mainstream media, that's for sure. People have to look outside of the mainstream media. But something that will attract the accusation of being a conspiracy theorist is the, you know, the propensity of people to go out there and start sort of putting stuff out there without knowing what they're talking about. You're going to attract the label of conspiracy theorist in any event, because that's sort of a contrived response to anybody that challenges the official narratives of events like JFK and events like 9/11, for sure. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be heading off to a break, Lauren. Before we do, though, on both 9/11 and with JFK, and I want to sort of draw the links between the two, I think both of you and I certainly agree, and so many more people now agree, that there was indeed a conspiracy to kill the president, JFK, back in 1963. And there was indeed a conspiracy surrounding 9/11. But most of the issues, though, or most of the debate and all of the books that have been written about both events have tended to sort of focus a lot on the actual process and on the mechanics and on the logistics and of how the buildings were brought down and all of that sort of thing. Very few people, it seems to me, the real serious investigators don't seem to touch on who was responsible, who were the principal perpetrators, what were their motives, and less about how they were able to actually bring about both events, but more about why they did and how they were able to cover it up. Can you give us a bit of an insight onto both of these events and perhaps the links between them in that context?
Yeah, sure. Do I have time to do it now or after the break?
You can certainly start. We've still got a couple of minutes to go. I realize that's a big question, and we can continue that after the break.
Sure. Okay. Well, there are different answers to that. There are different ways to look at the links. Of course, one basic link is that, you know, the Kennedy assassination created a huge lie, you know, in the mainstream media have been propagating a gigantic lie. And that created, you know, almost like it was like a psychological trauma on the collective level for America. And ever since, Americans have this sense that they've been lied to, they are continuously lied to, and you know, lies have a tendency to generate more lies. You know, in order to hide exactly. your lie, you have to lie more and more. So this completely changed the very nature of America. And of course, American mainstream media became a lying machine. And when you start to study JFK assassination and then 9/11, you little by little, you realize, you know, this machine, this media machine is basically a lying machine, a machine to build up more and more lies, to bury lies under new lies and so on and so on. It's not everything is a lie, but every issue dealing with foreign policy in particular is basically have very little connection to the truth. So that's one way to look at the connection between them.
Yeah. Laura, we'll go for a break and we'll continue this conversation. Listeners, you are on No Fly Zone with Greg Mabry. We're just going to take a short break and we'll be back very soon.
TNT Radio's Rick Munn.
Strikes in the UK are ongoing. There are rail strikes, postal workers strikes, and of course NHS strikes, ambulance workers strikes, nurses strikes, all coming up to Christmas time, all to cause maximum disruption. And I understand why they're striking. They want more money. Who doesn't, eh? Who doesn't want more money? Who doesn't need more money? But anyway, they're on strike, and Nadeem Zahawi, the arch rogue in the Tory party, has actually suggested that the nurses think twice about their Christmas strike because it would affect Putin. Because of Putin, believe it or not, he had the audacity to bring Putin into this. I don't think any nurses in the UK are interested in Putin right now. I think they're more interested in their working hours, their working conditions, and their take-home pay, whatever that pay may be. So yeah, Nadeem Zahawi, troll that he is talking about Putin in relation to their strikes.
He's locked and loaded. Rick Munn on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Wokeness is infiltrating churches, and people don't really know what's hitting them.
Critical race theory assumes that racism is everywhere, it is in everything. These ideologies have crept into the church.
I have grown up with this invisible kind of bag of privilege.
And I know, as a white pastor, I have blind spots.
Reparations fits into the scope of the gospel.
It's a racist worldview. You're swinging in racism.
The social justice warriors say, if you're white, you are racist. And if you say that you are not a racist, then you have to be a white supremacist.
I see within evangelicalism today an attack on the very gospel itself.
Social justice doesn't have to do with justice, it has to do with Marxism.
Wokeness is now the dominant academic paradigm on many university and college campuses.
Many of our Christian universities have fallen prey.
I went to an all-black school, raised in a black context. Everything was oppression. White people are racist, cops can't be trusted, and this world is not for us, it's against us. We felt like the government owed us. I have a family, I have children, and I don't have a job. I was just, it was at the darkest point in my life.
Because I was white, would we have to divorce and separate due to my skin color?
Christianity enables people to find forgiveness and redemption. However, Marxism is completely vindictive.
There is no redeemer and there is no redemption in the religion of anti-racism.
I believe that the evangelical church today is going to have to make a decision. Are we going to submit to the culture, or are we going to remain true to the faith and take the consequences?
How the left is stealing your church. The invasion of the gospel of woke at salemnow.com.
Childhood slavery. Proudly supporting a greener world. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back. It's Greg Mabry here on the No Fly Zone. I have with me today Lorraine Guinot, who is speaking to us about 9/11 and JFK assassination and the deep state or the national security state or shadow government. There are various terms that have been bandied about through the years that allude to the powers behind the throne, I guess, the ones that we very rarely hear talked about in mainstream media, that's for sure. Lauren, before we went to the break, we were talking about the media lies, and of course this is a recurring theme not just in my program but right across TNT and much of our alternative independent media is criticism of the mainstream media for not reporting or engaging in far too much propaganda and particularly more recently, far too much censorship. And certainly the JFK and the 9/11 events, they're almost synonymous with sort of media lies and misinformation and propaganda and censorship. Can you again sort of talk a little bit about both the events in the context of how the media responded to both of these events?
Well, yeah. As I said, I think the Kennedy assassination created a situation, created a media operation that continued and allowed 9/11 to happen because, you know, the machinery, the lying machinery was so elaborate that it was possible to pull out 9/11. And what I think is important is to realize that both these operations must be considered as coup d'etat, you know, because, you know, you murder a president, that's a coup, you know, that's the only reasonable way to look at it, unless, of course, you believe Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin, crazy guy. But I assume most people who are listening to us know that don't subscribe to that official theory. So if there was a conspiracy, and if some force killed a president and thereafter managed to get away with it for more than for now 60 years, you know, that force is tremendously powerful. You know, absolutely, because the big question is not so much how was it, who had the means to kill the president? Because, you know, honestly, when you look at the way he was, you know, in his limousine in Dallas, I mean, many people could have killed the president. The big question is who had the means to get away with it for 60 years, you know?
Yeah,
and these forces are so powerful that you have to look at it as a coup. And if you look at it as a coup, then you have to wonder then what changed, you know? What was the purpose of the coup? A coup d'etat is, the purpose of a coup d'etat is to change the government, and the purpose to change the government is to change the policy.
Yeah.
And the change of policy was almost invisible at the time. That's why so many people were willing to consider, well, it was just a crazy Lee Harvey Oswald who did it alone, because they didn't see really what changed. But today, 50 or 60 years later, we have enough we have enough information to know that something dramatically changed after from Kennedy to Lyndon Johnson. And if if you study a little bit, you understand that the big what really changed was the policy, American policy in the Middle East. You know, we went from a president who was basically a pro-Nasser or pro-Arab president who wanted to keep a balanced policy in the Middle East, who definitely was determined to prevent Israel from getting the nuclear weapon.
Yes.
To a president who was the first president who gave Israel everything Israel wanted, and did not want to interfere at all with their project to get the nuclear weapon, did not force them to apply the United Nations resolution for the return of the refugee, or didn't put any pressure at all to Israel, and even went much further than that, but actually committed high treason on his own country when he allowed the USS Liberty false flag attack and basically accepted Israel's phony excuse of mistaken identity.
Yeah.
So Lyndon Johnson today is regularly on the Israeli press. You hear a lot of praise for Lyndon Johnson. There are a few articles that I mention in my own articles that I quote. Lyndon Johnson was the best president, the best U.S. president that Israel ever had. You know,
in fact,
the special relationship between the United States and Israel, which I would compare to a psychopathic bond, you know, the complete control of the U.S. foreign policy by Israel, which is now almost commonly known, especially since the book by Mearsheimer and Walter, the Israel lobby.
An important book.
You know, it's quite well known that quite a few, you know, courageous politicians have made the point that Israel completely controls U.S. foreign policy. And this really started with Lyndon Johnson.
It certainly did. And you and I are very much on the same wavelength here on this. And we spoke about this the other day. I've written a number of articles on, you mentioned the USS Liberty. I wrote quite an extensive treatment on the whole USS Liberty and the Six-Day War and Lyndon Johnson's involvement in that and Israel's complicity in attacking the USS Liberty. It's a story we don't have time to go into now, but it is one that our listeners can certainly follow up. And on my Substack page, which I also include our podcast from the broadcast on the no-fly zone as well. But the Liberty story is, for me, one that has resonated for quite some time. And it is certainly very much emblematic of the way, if you like, or the sway that Israel has in Washington and its ability to be able to, as Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst, described of Israel's ability to be able to almost get away with murder. And certainly with Liberty, they were able to do this. But mind you, on this particular issue, Lyndon Johnson, you're quite right, was very much complicit in not only the attack on the Liberty, but also the cover-up that occurred. But getting back to, we've now reached what I consider to be the key points of our discussion today, and that's Israel's influence on American foreign policy. And of course, that influence extends to any of the major allies of the US, and that includes Australia. But I want to just go back to what were the actual reasons. If you're suggesting, and you have done this in some of your articles, you mentioned that JFK was very resistant to Israel wanting to obtain nuclear weapons. And that was the main reason, as I understand it, that's the main reason behind why you feel they felt threatened by Kennedy, and that would have given them the motive to become involved in any attempt to assassinate him. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah, I dedicated my book to Michael Collins Piper because he's the one who pioneered my book on the Kennedys, because he's the one who pioneered that theory that the main reason why Israel orchestrated the killing of President Kennedy is because he put incredible pressure on David Ben-Gurion to authorize inspection, because he knew Israel was trying to build nuclear weapons, and he was determined to prevent it. He was determined to prevent it because he had made it his life mission to denuclearize the world, you know. And this is very well demonstrated by James Douglas in his wonderful book, JFK and the Unspeakable. This was such an important goal for Kennedy. He wanted to, he made speeches to the United Nations, and he wanted to, and he had, of course, established communication with Nikita Khrushchev in the Soviet Union, and they were both agreeing and moving in that direction, in the direction of making a world without nuclear weapon. They had made a first step with the Test Ban Treaty and so on. But what James Douglas doesn't mention at all is that Kennedy's biggest problem was with Israel, because Israel was determined to get the nuclear weapon, because in the mind of David Ben-Gurion, this was a matter of life and death for their own country. So there was an intense struggle. So I agree with Michael Collins Piper's theory. This was the most urgent reason why David Ben-Gurion had to actually step aside. He resigned the day, this is one of the strangest aspect of the story, is that after Kennedy sent him a very strong letter with almost a threat, you know, that if he doesn't allow inspections right away, then American policy toward Israel will change dramatically. Then David Ben-Gurion, in order not to receive that letter, resigned for personal reasons. Yeah. Nobody really could give a clear explanation why he resigned. And then a few months later, of course, Kennedy was dead.
Exactly.
So, but I think there is a bigger picture to the Dimona story. Dimona being the place where
the plant, yes,
the nuclear plant. The bigger story is that Kennedy and Khrushchev were not only working toward denuclearizing the world; they were also both basically very friendly towards Nasser, toward Arab nationalism, toward the Pan-Arabic project. And, it's not difficult to understand that Ben-Gurion and the Israeli leadership were really panicked at the prospect of the Cold War ending, you know. How could I say? The Cold War would soon be ending by the two world leaders becoming friends with the Arab world. What would happen to Israel under those conditions? You know,
well, they were going. That would have undermined Israel's influence and clout and leverage if that were to happen. Yeah.
Absolutely, and that would have certainly destroyed Israel's plan for expansion, at the very least.
Exactly, which of course followed on later on after that period in 1967 with the Six-Day War, and that's of course when the USS Liberty was attacked, and that was a very pivotal moment, as you and I both know, not only for Israel and US relationships, but also the whole policy in the Middle East.
Yeah, there would never have been a Six-Day War under Kennedy. The only reason why there was a Six-Day War and Israel could destroy Egypt's air force in just one day is because they got all the information from the CIA, because Lyndon Johnson authorized the whole operation, basically.
And of course, they would have felt emboldened.
Yeah, we would have seen something similar to 1956 when Israel invaded the Sinai and Eisenhower
took over.
Reacted very strongly. Kennedy would certainly have reacted and prevented Israel from getting what they wanted. 1967.
Exactly. It's the situation, of course, with the 1967 war. Though, to me, the Israelis were emboldened. They knew that there was no way they were going to continue with their plans of expansion in the Middle East. This is my understanding of it. They knew that Kennedy would not have allowed that. We've got to go to a break. And we'll come back and we'll continue this fascinating conversation, Lorraine. You listen to Greg Mabry on the No Fly Zone. I have with me Lorraine Guino, who is a French author. We're talking about 9/11. We're talking about the JFK assassination and some of the big issues that relate to understanding what's happening in the world today.
A lot of self-proclaimed conservatives, and by conservatives we mean GOP shills, we're out taking victory laps today because Republican Herschel Walker lost the Senate runoff race in Georgia. Wait, what? Why would Republicans celebrate a Democrat win? Because they hate Trump and they hate us. Make no mistake, the GOP hates its base way more than they oppose their friends across the aisle. Most crowed how incompetent and unqualified Herschel was. Okay, now do John Fetterman. But their real agenda was exposed by one Republicrat wag who gleefully opined Georgia will go down in history as the state that broke Trump. Yes, please underestimate Donald Trump, and please underestimate his base. We beg you. But Mr. President, your endorsements and failures to endorse left a lot to be desired this cycle. We at MAGA Institute would love to help you identify vetted, genuine America First candidates that can win. Please have your people reach out to us. We'll be happy to help however we can. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Emergency, police, fire, ambulance. Yes, police, fire, or ambulance.
It's my friend.
Oh, okay, look, I need you to stay on the phone. Oh, just stay on the phone.
You're getting
blown. Okay, now hang on. Oh.
000's sole job is to connect you to emergency services. So please, stay on the line and you'll get help faster.
Info at your beck and call.
An earful of information.
Driving the news cycle.
Just tell your smart device to play
TNT Radio.
Hello, listeners, welcome back. You're listening to The No-Fly Zone with Greg Mabry. I have with me today author, writer and filmmaker Lorraine Guino, who has written some significant books and produced a terrific documentary on 9/11, and also most of the books cover the big issues or the big events, I suppose, of the deep state in America, JFK in particular, we have been talking about quite a bit. Before the break, Lauren, we were talking about the Six-Day War in Egypt, which was in between Egypt and Israel, and the significance of that event, and obviously the way that sort of things changed big time after that. And of course we have to refer back to the JFK assassination and how the US government's attitude towards Israel completely changed and its whole policy, if you like, towards the Middle East turned around. Of course, a lot of that policy shift that took place back then continues to reverberate now. As we know, and whilst we may not be able to explore a lot of the intricacies of that policy shift in the course of this interview, we will certainly follow up in later interviews, both with yourself and with other people who I have coming on the program to talk about these matters. But you mentioned Michael Collins Piper, and I just wanted to highlight with listeners Michael Collins Piper's book that Lorraine mentioned was, again, like our guest today, it was, for me, a very powerful introduction to a completely different narrative about the JFK assassination. Michael Collins Piper also, before he died, I think he passed away in about 2015 or 2016, I'm not sure, but he also had written quite a extensively on the connections between JFK, 9/11, and Israel's involvement in those events. What I'd like to do, Laurent, is to come back to some of the commonalities, I guess, if you like, between 9/11 and JFK, and not just Israel's involvement, but the broader deep state's involvement in bringing about these events. Can you sort of let us in on not only just the connections between the two events, who was involved, but again, how they've sort of how they are impacting on events that are unfolding now?
Well, yeah, it's difficult to, you know, talk about the similarities without getting into who was involved or who is behind those two events. Because in my view, you know, again, for 9/11, it's a little bit the same as for the Kennedy assassination. We have to look at what really changed. And it's more obvious when you look at 9/11 to see what changed, because as I said, it was not so easy for Americans. It was almost impossible for Americans to see what changed after Kennedy. The government, you know, Lyndon Johnson kept the same people in government and so on. So we can see it today in retrospect. But on 9/11, it was so clear. Actually, in my latest article on UNS Review, I mentioned actually, it was Piper who was first to point out this article published on September 11th in the at 1 p.m. New York time. So it was just after, you know, a few hours after the Twin Towers collapsed. George Friedman published an article on his website, Stratford.
Yes.
Yeah, it's quite amazing because the article begins with the big winner today, intended or not, is the state of Israel.
Yeah.
You know, so just a few hours after 9/11, after the attacks on the Twin Towers, on the World Trade Center, you know, anybody who was a bit aware of geopolitics could see the big winner would be Israel. Everything would change for Israel because suddenly Israel became the good guy in the Middle East, and the whole Arab world became the bad guys. And
see,
it was not
Benjamin Netanyahu.
It was not like that.
He said something similar after that too, didn't he? After the attacks, he said something similar that this is good for Israel, quote unquote. I think that was something along the lines of which he said.
Yeah,
and so he was echoing Friedman's assessment of how the 9/11 attacks would ultimately benefit Israel's objectives in the Middle East.
Absolutely, you know. So the similarity between the JFK assassination is that before those two events, Israel was under quite a lot of pressure on different issues, on the issues of the return of refugees, on all kinds of issues. And suddenly after the event, you know, Americans felt, you know, after 9/11, Americans felt, you know, very much pro-Israel and
great empathy.
Deep resentment toward the whole Arab world. And of course, the mainstream media amplified that resentment and portrayed the whole Arab world as basically a bunch of terrorist state. So, you know, if you look at it this way, the primary suspect, you know, is Israel. But then you have to, you know, you have to wonder, how can it be Israel? Israel is not is a foreign state. You know, how can Israel pull such an operation within the United States? Well, the point is that Israel is a very special state. Israel is a state with tens of thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands of people in the United States, in Europe,
yes,
in most Western countries, who are deeply dedicated to the state of Israel, even though they are citizens of another state. And some of those people are called Sayanim. You know, the term Sayanim has been popularized by Viktor Ostrovsky, a former Mossad agent. who explain how the Mossad works in other countries.
By way of deception. By way of deception, I think was his book, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. By way of deception. Yeah. So I came to think of, you know, if you look at 9/11 and the whole people who were in control of the World Trade Center at that time, starting with Larry Silverstein, whom everybody who has studied a little bit 9/11 knows, who bought the Twin Towers 6 weeks before 9/11, and all kinds of other people like the Greenbergs and Ronald Lauder
and
Frank Lowy.
All these people. He was an Australian as well, too.
Yeah, it's very easy to see that these people have the American citizenship, but they also have some of them Israeli citizenship, and they are deeply involved in supporting Israel in all kinds of way. And they have the means, they had the means and the opportunity to organize the event of the World Trade Center. And these people, I think it's best to consider them as basically super Zionism. So, you know, in this way, there is no contradiction between saying 9/11 was an inside job and saying, like I would do, and quite more and more people actually would start to say that this 9/11 was an Israeli job, because Israel, in many ways, is inside the United States, not only in the way AIPAC can control, for example, the foreign policy, but even deeper than that, in many other ways that Israeli, American crypto-Zionist in some way can help Israel get what they want from America. So
I mean, it'd be difficult, Laurent, in my view, to overstate the degree of influence and power that Israel and its allies, the Friends of Israel, so-called, wield in America generally, and particularly in the area of foreign policy. And we've got, you know, the neoconservative group who really rose to prominence in the wake of 9/11. And they still, to this day, to this very day, even in Ukraine, maybe not the actual same people themselves, but certainly the spiritual heirs of these people certainly are wielding clout in how America, how it sort of wields its own power in the world, or projects its own power in the world, and develops and implements foreign policy in all manner of places. We've seen it in Syria, we've seen it in Libya, we've certainly seen it in Afghanistan and Iraq particularly. And of course, they're still now banging on about Iran developing its own nuclear weapons as well. It's the same people that are really driving this. Yeah. Would you agree with that assessment?
Sure, of course. You mentioned the neoconservatives. Of course, we have to start by focusing on this group to understand, you know, how much Israel has now taken control of American foreign and military policy. And the thing about the neoconservatives is, if you look at their background, you know, the core neoconservatives are claimed to be influenced by Leo Strauss. So you have to study a little bit Leo Strauss, and we don't have time to get into that. But it's very enlightening to really get deeply into what did they get from Leo Strauss. And the point is that the neoconservatives, you know, they're basically a public relation image is that they are liberals who suddenly became conservatives because they realized that, you know, and then they helped Reagan to win the election, and then they became Republicans, you know, and so on. But in reality, neoconservatives, I call them crypto-Zionists, because they're not conservatives at all. They're really radicals in many ways, and they can be Republicans, they can be Democrats. Doesn't really matter, because their only real concern is foreign policy, and foreign policy.
And within that, of course, that Israel is to do with Israel.
Yeah, it's to connect it to ultimately connected to Israel. I think it has become very clear to many people over the years, because first of all, we, you know, nobody was supposed to say the neoconservatives were Jewish, but everybody knows they are. Most of them, the core neoconservatives are all coming from the, you know, intellectual Jewish movement.
And they have dual passports, and their alliance and allegiance to Israel is, in many cases, they're very open about it. I don't think that's any big secret, but of course, you know, it is something that doesn't really receive a lot of airplay. You mentioned, Lauren, and I want to go back to Zionism. I've myself written, and I'm in the process of writing, a series of articles on the whole ideological construct of Zionism and its history, and how it was actually the if you like, the catalyst for the creation of Israel. Can you give our listeners just a bit of an idea of Zionism? Everybody has a bit of an understanding of communism or Nazism or socialism or any of these other isms, but Zionism is a word that's bandied around a lot, but I honestly don't think a lot of people really quite understand not just Zionism, but its links to Israel, its links to Judaism, and all of that sort of thing. And, of course, the impact of Zionism on not just the US foreign policy, but also on the world. Can you give us a bit of a handle on that? It's a big question, I know, but we've got about 5 minutes left before we go to the break, but I'd like to just get your ideas on Zionism. What is it?
Okay. Well, yeah, it's a complicated question, and there are many different opinions on that question. What is Zionism? You know, the classic answer would be Zionism is just one version of nationalism. You know, it happened in the 19th century. You know, in Europe, many peoples were becoming nationalist. They tried to find their own identity, and then Theodor Herzl kind of surfed on that wave and developed a project to create a national state for the Jews and so on. And Theodor Herzl was considered a secular Jew. He was not religious at all. And it's true, if you read his book, you know, there's not much religion in there. But then Zionism has morphed at some point after Theodor Herzl's death, or even before he died, actually. The Zionist movement was taken over by another kind of Jewish group, who were actually not only nationalist, they were not nationalist in the European traditional sense of the 19th century, because they were deeply involved with the Bible, with the Hebrew Bible. And the best way to understand this is to look at David Ben-Gurion himself, because he's considered the father of Israel, you know, the founding father. And David Ben-Gurion's biography, you have a few biographies. One is called The Prophet of Fire, and every chapter has a title, has a Bible quote as a title, because the biographer, I forgot his name, wants to show that basically David Ben-Gurion was deeply possessed, you know, by the biblical narrative. The Bible for Zionists, you can still see that today. Even Benjamin Netanyahu brings out the Bible all the time. In 2017, I think he came to the United States, and in front of the Congress, he mentioned about, he compared Iran to the Persia of the Book of Esther. And, you know, the Bible, the biblical, the Hebrew Bible is still today basically the foundation of the national narrative. And David Ben-Gurion was the, you know, archetypal Zionist in this sense. You know, he was profoundly influenced by the biblical vision. And so what even is the biblical... Sorry?
Even if many don't even believe in God, as some of them have actually...
Exactly, there's a classic misunderstanding, which is because Christians look at the Hebrew Bible as their own Old Testament. But in fact, it's almost like it's not the same book, because Jews don't read it at all like Christians read it. And for many Jews, like David Ben-Gurion, I mentioned him, but actually most of the Israeli leaders after David Ben-Gurion are in the same mold. They don't look at the Bible as a religious book. They really look at it as a book of history and a book of a program for the destiny of Israel. What they read in the Hebrew Bible is the destiny of Israel to become the center of the world. You know, so there is a kind of supremacist ideology within Zionism, which of course they don't want to overemphasize as a public image, but it's definitely there. You know, Zionism, Laurent, if you ask me to summarize it, you know, in one word, is a form of supremacism.
Yeah, I would definitely go along. We have to finish up, Laurent. I just want to quickly direct people to where you, where listeners can find it. On the UNS Review is possibly the best place to go and find out more about our guest today and about the topics of today. Listeners, we're going to be finishing up very, very shortly. I wanted to sort of thank Laurent Guino for participating in our conversation today. It was very, very enlightening, and I can assure you, Laurent, at some point in time in the new year, we're going to have you back on board.